Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome to a Big Squid presentation of our science fiction segment, Space Podyssey. My name is Justin Hamilton, and today Ben Elwood and I are discussing the 2002 remake of Solaris. It's our first Space Podyssey episode for Season 6. It's one of your favourite segments. It's one of my favourite segments. And I think it's one of your favourites. I get a lot of emails after every episode. So that suggests to me that it is one of your favourites. Anyway, it's our first one for Season 6. And we welcome Ben Elwood back for the first time this season as well. So it's a double win for you. Space Podyssey and Ben Elwood. What a mix. What a heady mix. I won't go into it too much now, but I liked this movie a lot when it first came out. I saw it at the cinema, but like a fine wine, it has aged beautifully, and now it feels like a lost or maybe at least an underappreciated classic. And yeah, like this was my favorite viewing of this film, and I feel like I've caught up to it. So anyway, I'm looking forward to you listening to this podcast, but I'm also interested to know what you think of this film as well. So if you're a Patreon supporter, you can write to me there, or if you're just on the private Facebook page, that's always a good place to write to me. And if you're not on either of those, just head to the open Facebook page as well and drop me your thoughts. I'm keen to know what you think of this film. Two quick things, though, before we launch into the podcast. I have a solo show coming up in Sydney and Melbourne. That's right, and Melbourne. And it is my first solo show in either city for a long time, like a really long time. I think I don't think I've performed in Melbourne since 2019. And like I've been doing gigs in Sydney, but I don't think I've done a solo show in Sydney since maybe 2018. Like, it's been a while. So this new show is called Little Victories. It'll be performed at the Sydney Comedy Store on the 28th of October and Comedy Republic in Melbourne on the 26th of November. So I would love to see you there. I would love to know that people still want to see me perform live. That would be good. Please don't think you'll catch me next time. I haven't been around for a while, so I need to know that you're still out there. I'm needy. I need an audience. Well, every comedy show needs an audience, but I'm just more comfortable in letting you know that it really does help me to have an audience. But anyway, for more details, head to bigsquidpod.com. And if you go to the blog page, there is a whole section where you will find ticket options for both cities and maybe even a little bit of insight into how this show came about. So there you have that. But it honestly would be fantastic to see you. Feel free to bring friends as well. That would be nice. I would be really, really grateful. Anyway, I should stop being so needy. If Adam Richard was here, he'd be furious. Long-time listeners of the podcast will also know that my Patreon subscribers have an episode dedicated to them. And today's shout-out goes to Salicia. Salicia, thank you so much for being part of the Big Squid community. I hope you enjoy today's chat. And if you haven't seen Solaris before, maybe this might be an introduction to an underrated film that deserves more props. Anyway, thanks for your support, Salicia, and it is very much appreciated from me and everyone that I work with. If you'd like an episode dedicated to you and have access to bonus podcasts, works in progress, scripts, and discounted tickets to live events, head to patreon.com/ Justin Hamilton _ Big Squid, and you will find a tier that suits you. That actually does remind me, as Big Squid listeners, you do get money off my solo shows. So if you go in to buy those tickets, make sure you use the promo code podcast, and that will get you a cheaper ticket. And Patreon subscribers, head to the Patreon page, and you will find the super duper discount that is just for you. So lots of opportunities to save a bit of coin there on live stuff. All right, it is now time to join psychologist Chris Kelvin as he is sent to an isolated research station that orbits a strange new world. The crew have gone missing, and Kelvin must discover why they have ceased their contact back to Earth. But once he arrives, his troubled past begins to manifest as he attempts to unravel the mystery of the planet known as Solaris.
Can I help you?
We're looking for Dr. Chris Kelvin.
We've received no contact from the Solaris expedition for 6 months.
Why not send in the security force?
We did. We feel confident that if you can manage to board the ship, you can negotiate their safe return.
Can you tell me what's happening here?
I could tell you what's happening. But I don't know if I'd really tell you what's happening.
That's not my son. My son is on Earth. And that's not your wife.
Where did you come from?
They are part of Solaris.
From Academy Award winners James Cameron and Steven Soderbergh.
How long do you think you can go without sleep?
Whatever you desire.
You're being manipulated.
Whatever you fear.
Don't leave me! Don't leave me!
That's not human, and I'm threatened by that!
Whatever you think.
She's alive.
Becomes real.
If all we know, it's driving us crazy so we can watch us kill each other.
What does Solaris want from us?
If you keep thinking there's a solution, you'll die here.
What if what's happening here started happening on Earth?
George Clooney.
Please, no!
Unlock the door!
You don't know what you're in for.
I'm just going to start off with this question before we even really get into the movie. But is Solaris Interstellar without big action pieces?
Yeah. And without a pipe organ giving you a fucking anxiety hemorrhage.
Right, it never gave me an anxiety hemorrhage. It gave me a panic erection, but no anxiety. But no, so I hadn't watched the film in a while.
Yeah.
And I enjoyed it when it first came out. I thought it was really good. Mm. And we'll talk a little bit later about how it went at the box office, etc. Mm. But kind of watching it now, Mike, it feels a little bit ahead of the curve. It's like, so maybe... Maybe you would say that Gravity is the start of the new wave of philosophical science fiction that continues with movies like Interstellar, Arrival, Ad Astra, etc. And, you know, this viewing of the film was actually my favorite because it feels it feels relevant. It feels brand new. It feels like it's a part of the zeitgeist. But it came out in 2002, and it's like, I think this was just a little bit ahead of the curve, actually.
Yeah, absolutely, and I think it's doing that thing that so much of the stuff that came after it did, where, you know, it's not really about space,
Right.
It's not really about it, you know, zooming around some weird nebula. You know, it's that very exploration is of a very nuanced human condition.
Yeah.
With the kind of the sci-fi seasoning on the top.
Yeah.
But it had to be, you know, if it's a remake or, you know, a spin of the original Solaris, it has to get into these very deep philosophical issues.
Right. Yeah. And I kind of feel like maybe, once again, when we get to the squid bits, we'll talk about the marketing, and the marketing really kind of did not get it. And once again, that's what I think is where it's ahead of the curve because some of that marketing just, there's a disconnect. Like if you look at the old posters and you watch the old trailer, it's like, this feels like it's When Harry Met Sally in Space.
How are they marketing it?
It's really weird. Yeah, we're recording this before I put this all together, and you know, normally I'll play the trailer beforehand. Yeah. I'm not sure I'll play the trailer. Like, it's so weird.
What is it?
It's just
George Clooney had a conundrum in space.
Well, I feel like it's not that far away from that. And it's like, what were you guys doing? You know, they saw him with his bare bum and they all got excited.
Of course the bare bum's in the trailer.
No, it's not in the trailer. But you just feel like the people in marketing went, oh, George Clooney is naked at some point. This is a romantic movie.
Do you reckon they were maybe afraid of the depth of the themes of it all? I think you look at the it's a very different film, but it's similar in kind of its human depth. You look at the trailer for The Fountain.
Yes.
And that is an abysmal trailer.
Yes.
That really fucks it up as well.
Yes.
He loved her over three time periods. It's not.
What?
But that, I mean, it was clearly a marketing team that didn't know how to market a very heady kind of cerebral, emotional film.
Yeah. So, you know, like our first question normally is, you know, when did you first see this movie? I saw this in Adelaide. I think I may have been at a Fringe Festival or something, and I went with my old pal Terry Siarkis, and I think we may have been like two of four people in the cinema, and we came, I remember walking out of it and both of us just like, that's not what we expected. And it was because we'd obviously seen the trailer beforehand, and then you get this very heady philosophical tale that has some really horrifying moments in it.
Horrifying.
And it's...
Did you... When you walked out of it, it was 2011, right?
No, 2002.
Holy shit. Okay, yeah, so when you walked... Whoa!
Yeah, that's what I mean about it being ahead of the curve.
Yeah, okay, sorry. Like I was living in 2011 land. That's
No. Okay, so that's what I mean. It's like, you know, you watch it...
Wow.
And you go, okay, if you throw in a couple of big set pieces, like, it's got a Dylan Thomas poem, like Interstellar as well.
You're 100, because when you said it's ahead of its curve, I was like, yeah, I guess so. But now that in 2002, holy shit.
So, you know, so hang on, before we go, when did you first see it?
Only a few years ago.
A few years ago, yeah.
At home.
Yeah.
I think I even borrowed it off you.
I think you did too, So the segment Google Me Chuck, the top four responses when you Google Solaris. Is Solaris good? 2002. What was the point of Solaris? Is Solaris a good movie? What does the ending of Solaris mean? People are fucking confused about this film, right? But the segment First Context, where we name the sci-fi movies that came out before and after, 1996, Independence Day, 1997, Starship Troopers, 1998, The Truman Show, 1999, The Matrix, 2000, Mission to Mars, 2001, Donnie Darko, 2003, you get movies like the second X-Men film and Terminator 3, Rise of the Machines, 2004, I, Robot. Like, it's... You know, this is Clooney and Soderbergh really kicking goals, and they've decided to make this film. And I think the mainstream audience were just like, what's happening?
I wonder if it's ahead of its time, or if it's kind of the capper on some more cerebral sci-fi that came before it. Kind of maybe the pinnacle of just before this real kind of decline for a good decade into remakes and superheroes and just over the top CGI, because I think around that time, 2004, was when that awful Keanu Reeves the remake of the 50s film
The Day the Earth
Stood Still, that was around that time that those kind of like heavy CG grey-blue movies started coming out. So, yeah, maybe it was the kind of pinnacle of something that was being built towards that then dropped off and came back 10 years later.
Yeah, well, because it's a remake of the Russian film, which is... Have you seen the Russian version? Yeah. And I really like the Russian version.
It's very different.
Yeah. But I don't know. There's something... It honestly feels like if you drop this in between Interstellar and The Martian.
Totally.
It's like it makes total sense.
Absolutely.
Total sense as a film. And I reckon they'd know how to market it properly and it would be much better. The year that it came out, you had the sci-fi movies were 28 Days Later, Minority Report, Men in Black 3, Simone.
What's Simone?
That's the one. I'd be curious to go back and watch that now. That's the one where it's an Al Pacino movie and it didn't do very well, but he's a director and the actress pulls out, so he makes an electronic one an AI version and is not letting people interview her because he's still passing her off as real. And and Winona Ryder, I think, plays a bit of an arsehole in it. And there's one of those things where you go, I'm fully prepared that I could watch it and go, no, this isn't good, but I also wonder if it's a little bit prescient.
Hidden gem.
Maybe. Maybe. Even if it doesn't work, it might still be prescient.
Yeah.
But then you've got really mainstream movies this year like Spider-Man, Star Wars Episode II, Attack of the Clones, and Star Trek Nemesis.
Wow, so I'm still mind blown that it came out in 2002.
Yeah, I know.
That's fucking crazy.
And I even think the special effects are way better than, than people were probably prepared for.
The way it's shot, everything. It doesn't feel like a very early 2000s movie at all.
And, you know, for an interesting thing about the film is it looks $1 million, right? Mm. Like, I think it looks absolutely great, but I'm just looking this up to check that I'm right. The budget for the film was $47 million.
What's that in 2002 money, though?
Well, like...
Mid-range movie.
You know, it's kind of expensive for what it is.
Yeah.
But I reckon it looks...
Oh, it looks incredible. And that beautiful set,
you
know, that's really brought to the fore when he's chasing the mirage of the little kid around.
Yes.
And you really get the idea of, like, wow, this is an actual spaceship. So
yeah.
It's brilliant.
Yeah. Yeah.
Very beautiful.
I think the other film that I'd be curious to go back to is Sunshine. And that came out in 2007.
Yeah.
I feel like that's really quite good up until a story choice right at the end where you're going, hang on, did this just become a completely different film?
Yeah, I'm not usually one of those people that goes, oh, the last 10 minutes kind of fuck up the whole movie. But in that case, it really it really prevents me from ever wanting to go back and revisit that movie.
Yeah, yeah. And I remember sitting...
It's a bold swing, but it's not good.
No, I feel the same way. It's interesting to see Clooney and Soderbergh take a swing here at Russian Classic. To give you an idea of where George Clooney is. So you remember he's in ER and like... ER is every week 30 to 35 million people are watching that. Every episode, 22, 24 episodes a season.
Yeah,
he signs a 5-year contract and he's the only star who doesn't renegotiate. He stays at the same price because his deal is I signed a 5-year contract. I'm going to stick by my word and then I'm done.
Wow.
So everyone else renegotiated, which they're quite... You know, they're allowed to do.
Yeah.
And then he, he starts making little forays into movie world and some successful, some not so successful. But around 1998, he does Out of Sight, which is, I rewatched that a couple of weeks ago and I was like, this is still one of the fucking coolest films ever made. Like, it's just cool.
Him and Cameron Diaz, right?
No. Jennifer Lopez.
Oh, Jennifer Lopez, sorry.
And she is fucking out of control. Like, I saw that film and I was like, even now when I'm not a fan of her movies or her music, I fucking love her with all my heart. Like, do you know what I mean? She's my guilty secret off the back of this film.
Great.
And because it also has those great little cameos of Michael Keaton and Samuel L. Jackson from Jackie Brown.
Oh, they're playing the same characters.
Yeah, awesome.
Awesome.
So it's still super cool. The sex scene is fucking hot and it's funny.
He is hot.
Yeah.
Like this shot of him, the shot of him in the shower in this movie.
Holy shit.
It was holy shit. It was like a drawing of the ideal Bruce Wayne.
Yes.
After a night of crime fighting.
Yes. Yes. Well, that's the irony. Like, yeah. You know, he just got the worst Batman film.
But that was the thing. As I was watching it, I was like, wow, he'd be such a great Bruce Wayne. And then it suddenly occurred to me, wait a second, he fucking was. Yeah. And he was the worst Bruce Wayne.
Yeah. But he got the worst film. Of course. You know, there's only so much he can do.
Because the Bat credit card.
Well, when he signed up for it, he thought he was... He was under the impression they were kind of making... it was kind of sold to him as a Dark Knight Returns.
Yeah, right.
And then, you know, really early on, he turned around to Chris O'Donnell and Alicia Silverstone and said, this movie is not much, so we're going to have fun.
Of course.
But but he makes Out of Sight in 98. He makes Three Kings in 99.
Great movie.
And then... I've made a mistake here.
Batman was 97.
Yes, yeah. That's a while back. And, you know, like it was a... You know, I've told this story so many times, but as I said when I met him, the thing about Batman is it put him in a position where he could meet Soderbergh, and that they could make Out of Sight. And Out of Sight is, as I said, just a great film. But anyway, in 2001, he makes Ocean's 11, mm-hmm. which is super cool mm-hmm, as mm-hmm. well.
Yep.
So they're on a roll, and yep. then. And then they make this, you know, and this is... And then they said at the time, while you've got the keys to the kingdom, you've got to try and make as much as you can. You've got to take swings and you've got to try and make quality films.
Yep.
And they produce a lot of films, a lot of small level $35, $40 million movies that don't normally get made to just try and make quality.
Yeah,
and I think they do a really, really good job with this. And I, as I said, rewatching this film, I was like... I remember enjoying it, and I obviously own a copy of it, but this is the most I've enjoyed it because I feel like everything I've learned through doing this segment and re-engaging with sci-fi in a different way allowed me to enjoy this and appreciate it even more.
Yeah, it was definitely, I think I was kind of indifferent to it the first time I saw it.
Yeah.
And then this time, about 20 minutes in, I felt, you know, when you get the hairs on the back of your neck, like, ooh, this is good.
This is really good. It's really good. Anyway, I kind of enjoy it more than the Russian one. And I know the Russian one is
I just think they're very different experiences.
What I mean is I enjoy the experience of this film.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Because I only saw the Russian one this year for the first time.
Oh, yeah, right. And it's great.
It's great, but it felt like homework.
Yes.
And it was probably, you know, I just watched Stalker on your recommendation, and I loved every second of that.
Ooh.
So good.
Yeah.
And so I think 3 days later, I was like, I'm going to do Solaris. And like 20 minutes in, I was like, oh, I'm not in that space. Like that Tarkovsky kind of like surrender to the meditative slow burn of it. So I do want to go back to it.
Yeah.
So... But yeah, I think you're right. I think I enjoyed the experience of this Solaris a bit better.
Yeah. I just thought it was wonderful.
Yeah.
So the movie opens on Clooney's character, who is a clinical psychologist, Dr. Chris Kelvin, who is living what appears to be a normal work life, albeit one that is lonely. And it's a pretty low-key start to the film, isn't it? And I have to say, one of my favourite things in a good sci-fi film is, you know, when it feels slightly like the future. Not too far in the future, just slightly like the future.
Yep.
And it feels relatable, you know? Like, you can see that there's been some advancements, but there's not too many advancements.
Yeah, the collar is a little higher.
Yes.
There's some angles on the steps.
Yeah. It's good. It's just enough to keep you a little bit off balance.
Yeah.
And there's kind of a low hum in the audio, which kind of adds to the claustrophobia.
The unremarkableness of the future.
Yes.
I think that's what's really, you know, the best sci-fis do that so well.
Yeah.
You know, where it's like, it's not really commenting on itself. It's that kind of the gradual creep of technology and advancements. And you know, it's just integrated in where no one really notices anymore, which is exactly true to reality.
Yes.
You know, we all carry supercomputers in our pockets and no one seems to care.
Yeah. Yeah, and we just, you know, it's always my favourite thing when you hear people just say, oh, there's science fiction, it's just so, I don't know, it's just so crazy and I just don't like it. It's like, you live in a science fiction world.
Of course. Of course.
You know, worrying about climate change, you know what that is? That's sci-fi.
Totally. There's Philip K. Dick books. I think it's Ubeck.
Yeah.
Where he talks about the heat wave. So basically no one can go outside anymore. Everyone just lives in these interconnected apartment blocks.
Yes.
And there's kind of sky bridges between each block because you can't go outside anymore. And then one day the air conditioning turns off for 3 minutes.
Yes.
And in the space of 3 minutes, everyone's vinyls melt and all their parrots die because of the intensity of the heat outside.
Yeah.
It's like, well, you know, we're not that far off, guys.
Right. I remember reading that and instead of thinking, wow, that's a crazy future, I was thinking, I wonder how quickly we can implement that. The colours at the start of this film are beautiful. It's a beautiful film.
It's very
actually.
Pretty. Yeah.
Kelvin is visited by emissaries from DBA, a corporation operating a space station that orbits the planet Solaris. It is from a scientist friend, Dr. Jabarian, who requests Kelvin comes to the space station to help understand a strange phenomenon occurring there. DBA is confused because none of the astronauts want to return home, and they have lost contact with the security patrol sent to the station. Kelvin decides to go, and when he arrives, he finds the base covered in bloodstains. Dr. Jabarian has committed suicide, and the two survivors, reluctant to explain what has happened. The reason I read all of that out, and I normally wouldn't do all of that, is because do you off the top of your head know how long that took in the movie?
I was about to say, this is the biggest disparity between this version and the original.
Yes, I know.
I think we're in space, what, less than 10 minutes?
Mate, everything I just read to you, 16 minutes.
16 minutes. And we're in space 16 minutes into the film?
Well, we're already seeing like the what's his name's committed suicide and, you know, the
fucking
other two
hell.
Survivors.
16 minutes into the original, I think we're still in the house watching the video of the guy saying...
Mate, he's still putting on his shoes. Like, it's crazy, right?
There's that sequence in the original Solaris where they drive.
Yes.
For, I think it's like 4 minutes.
Yeah.
Where it's just looking out a window for 4 minutes. Yeah. I mean, again, it's Tarkovsky. It's that whole... What does he say? Sculpting in time.
Yes.
Where you surrender to this is... We are observing
and
the
And I
moment.
Do love that.
I love it as well. But I cracked up when he was in space in this one. I was like, oh my God.
Yeah, fuck.
It's like real economy of form.
Yeah, let's get to it. But it's... But also, like, so much happens.
Yeah.
Like, it's masterful storytelling. It's just like, bam, 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 bam. Moves along at a rapid rate. And, you know, because it's somehow a little bit languid as well.
Yeah.
Like, it's not... It doesn't feel... Like, I was shocked. That's why I wrote that note down as I was looking. I was like... God, how long have we... 16 minutes!
No, there's an incredible... It's incredible how you can play with time where if you just don't rush, and you kind of... There's this wonderful animation that I've been watching at the moment called Primal.
Okay.
It's one of the best things I've ever seen. It's by this master animator, Genndy Tarkovsky.
Yeah.
His probably most famous thing was a show called Samurai Jack.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
And this is... It's set in caveman times. Well, it's a hybrid of dinosaur and caveman times. It's this caveman who loses his entire family and he becomes best friends with a Tyrannosaurus Rex that has lost her babies.
Right.
And it's like wild kind of... But the pacing of it... For each episode is basically follows the formula of it's 20 minutes and for the first 10 minutes... Virtually nothing happens. It'll just be them walking through a field.
Yeah.
Maybe hunting a boar.
Yeah.
And at the 10-minute mark, some creature, a woolly mammoth or a giant bat or something will come out and the next 10 minutes is the most insane carnage you've ever seen in your life.
Right.
And every episode I watch, by the time the carnage has kicked off, you know, logically, it's only been 10 minutes. It feels like... Hours have passed.
Right.
Because of just the time that is taken with just the T-Rex sniffing the air. They'll spend like 15, 20 seconds. It doesn't sound like a lot, but when you add these 15, 20 second chunks up of really not much happening, it just stretches time. So when it does kick off, you know, it feels like an assault every time.
Right.
And it's, but and I think this movie does that. That real masterclass in you don't need a lot of time to feel like you've spent a lot of time.
Yeah. Like, in everything I read out, I've left out the bits where we just saw him by himself, just kind of sitting there contemplating.
And the brief meeting, and
talking to some of his
patients.
And also, we've seen him cut a vegetable and cut his finger.
Yeah.
Like,
you really get an idea of the, maybe not the man, like all the nuance, but you understand the overarch. This is a man who is lost.
Yeah.
There's a man who seems racked with grief.
Yep.
Something's missing.
Yep.
You know, there's a lot is delivered in a really economical, elegant way.
Oh, it's, as I said, I feel like I'm going to say after every little section, I enjoyed this the most this time, but I really enjoyed this the most.
Yeah.
We'll get to the surviving crew members later. I think they're all pretty interesting, so I want to delve into them properly a little bit further down. But after Kelvin sees a young boy running about the station, he goes to sleep and dreams about his long-dead wife, Rhea. In the dream, he remembers how they met and their most romantic and intimate moments. And when he wakes, Rhea is there.
Horrifying.
Like...
And he reacts appropriately.
Yes. Yes. And... You know, there's, once again, it takes, when he's having these dreams, and it takes its time explaining the relationship, how it comes to be the first time they see each other on the train. And it's, for a moment, you're like, is this a romantic movie?
Hmm.
Like, is this, like, and it's also silent, to, like, not silent as in nothing, but there's no dialogue. It's a lot of looks and...
That's the beauty of it.
And I feel like... I reckon maybe the marketers went, okay, yep, no, nah, we know what this movie is. And then they went and started marketing it.
Yeah, of course.
And then went...
Yeah. But it depicts that real kind of like ideal of romance.
Yeah.
You know, like the kind of romance that you dream of having, you know, love at first sight.
Yeah.
Everything told through looks. And
yeah.
Have you ever had one of those? Have you ever gotten together with someone from just a look across a room?
Like, so many times I can't pick one. I can't really think. I don't really think so. I can't think of anyone off the top of my head. If I do remember one, I'm more than happy to share it.
It's
have you?
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
It was full on.
Yeah.
It was my first proper girlfriend.
Okay.
And I was working at the Comedy Store. And she was just there, and the show ended. She was in the audience, and the show ended, and she just left. And we just locked eyes from across the room.
Yeah, right.
And we both just started like going, like laughing. We'd never seen each other in our lives.
Right.
And she left, and I'm not a fucking player. Like I'd never asked someone out before. I'd never approached anyone before anything. But she left. And something just came over me, and I just kind of ran down out to the front of the Comedy Store.
Right.
And I was like, hey. And she's like, hey. I was like, well, are you leaving? And she's like, yeah, I'm leaving. I was like, you should stay. And she stayed, and we were together for 5 years. It was
But it was like, that's really great.
But it was like, it was something, you know, it was a look that was undeniable.
Yeah, right.
It was crazy.
Right. Maybe I've missed all those opportunities because I spend a lot of time in my own head. So if someone's looking at me, I'm in my head thinking, wonder what Papa Bowie would do if he was still alive. Would he write to his son? Anyway. That's a very nice story, though.
But that was really conveyed in this depiction of romance.
Yeah.
It was it's all done through instinct and feeling rather than explanation or witty banter or whatever.
Yeah.
Like it's very primal.
Yeah. There's a nice little moment of coincidence of them being in the same place.
Yeah, which seems to infuse a fate into it as well.
Yeah. Did you notice that when he's sleeping, dreaming about her, and then when he's in the when it cuts back to the space station and he's laying there asleep, when her hand comes up over his neck, it looks like a fucking face hugger.
Oh yeah, absolutely. It looks like something crawling out of a crypt or something.
Yeah. It's a very interesting choice.
Yeah,
Soderbergh, you legend.
Yeah.
And then they're immediately like his response is great, and. I think Natasha McElhone, she is so amazing in the role. The fact that she's playing a manifestation of his memory of how he remembers her.
Yeah.
And but also is suddenly aware that she doesn't know how she got there and doesn't know how this has all come about. Mm. It's mind-blowing. Mm. And once again, you're sitting there, you're thinking, this is full on. How's this going to play out? And how does it play out? He puts her in a space pod and fucking jettisons her out into space. And it is one of the most haunting scenes in any of the movies we've watched.
No, absolutely. It's horrifying. I mean,
like, it's so full on.
I had no memory of this film from the first time I watched it, apart from that moment.
Yes.
That moment was seared in.
Yeah.
Seared
in for me too.
Awful. Because, you know, it's like, it's metaphorically true as well of what you wish you could sometimes do with memories of certain people.
Right, yeah, yeah. Just
stuff it in a capsule.
Yeah, and fucking fire it up into a strange planet so I don't have to deal with this anymore.
Leave me alone.
Yeah, I know. And I, once again, I think part of the failure of this film at the box office is that, you know, people, they're going into to see this so-called romantic sci-fi movie, and there's George Clooney jettisoning a woman into space.
Yeah.
It's
with no consequence,
right? With no consequence, and also, but all, you know, if people haven't watched this film and they're thinking, "Oh, I'll listen to the podcast first to feel like if I want to watch it," you understand why he's done it because.
Oh yeah, it's not. He's not. Yeah,
he's freaked out. Like, it's because we do learn that she has his real wife. You know, at one point discovered that she was pregnant.
Yep.
And decided to abort the baby before telling him that she was pregnant. Mm-hmm. They have a fight and he leaves, and then she commits suicide and he comes back to kind of reconcile and she's gone. So to then have this, her there is like, you can't blame him.
Well, and it's and you know, he's also been flagged that there's some weird shit going down on this space station. Like, it's like she's obviously a ghost or an alien or some kind of mirage. There's something going on. That fight they have, I'm sure we'll get to it, but that...
Let's discuss it now.
Fucking hell, man. That fucking moment where she goes... What does she say? I can't do this. I can't remember what she says, but his response is, "Then you'll have to do it alone."
Yeah,
you'll have to be on your own, or you have to like live without me.
Yeah,
but the savagery with how he says it, and then what the consequence of that is.
Yes,
is like that's one of my worst nightmares. It's why I try whenever I have conflict with friends or family to not leave it.
Yeah.
Stewing.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I always like to resolve shit before we part.
Yeah.
Because I've always had that fear
of
saying something fucking horrific and, you know,
coming
back and uh-oh.
yeah. No, I totally get that. I think that's a really good trait to have, actually.
Yeah.
And, you know, because she obviously has mental health issues, which once again was not a term used back in 2002, and why I think the movie would probably hit harder now.
Yeah.
But she has we see that she has mental health issues. And then when, you know, like, you see an erosion in their relationship, and we'll talk about some of the conversations that take place. But then when she makes that decision to have the abortion, and then, like, everyone's reactions are understandable. Yeah. And
no one's wrong.
No. It's just, it's so good.
Yeah.
So you're probably wondering, if you haven't watched the movie, why is this happening? It turns out the planet Solaris is manifesting the loved ones of the crew. The little boy is the dead person's Javarian son. And let's discuss the planet. What are your thoughts on what is happening?
Because
I have a theory.
I don't know that it's hostile. I don't think it's trying to fuck with people.
No.
I
totally agree.
Maybe it's giving people what they think that they want as a way of confronting that notion.
Right.
Of like, what you think you want isn't necessarily good for you.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, so this is what I wrote down. right? So there's a scene later in the movie, and we were discussing that their kind of relationship is eroding. And we see a dinner where there's a debate over whether there is a God or a higher power. And Kelvin thinks humans are an inevitable probability and that the idea of God was dreamed up by man. Yet there are higher powers in the universe, even if they're not gods. And what I think is Solaris, as this unknowable entity, is connecting to the crew who have suddenly turned up floating around the planet. And I completely agree with you. I don't think Solaris is trying to scare them or control them. I think Solaris is trying to understand who they are and in turn understand itself. So it taps into memories of loved ones but can only build from the cognizant memories. And the manifestation of Rhea is smart but also knows that whatever is wrong with her is from Kelvin's memory. And there's that scene where she looks back at the planet wishing that she could communicate. And it's just like religious people looking to the sky and wishing they could communicate with their version of God. Solaris isn't playing God. Solaris is doing what they're all doing, which is trying to understand itself.
Wow.
Anyway, I'm not saying that's correct.
No. I think that's probably, you know, I've often thought that about, you know, if that's what consciousness is.
Right.
If it is just the kind of creative force of the universe trying to understand itself.
Right. Right,
you know, manifesting in not even necessarily consciousness in an evolved sense as we have, you know, just all manifestations of consciousness.
Like, yeah.
You know, what is the experience of being a bird? What is the experience of being a tree? You know, and what is the knowledge to be gained from that? Like, how can I understand myself better?
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, the universe does look like a brain, and we just might be a neuron.
I really think that. Like, you know, I don't think there is a God. Like,
yeah.
I don't think there's a creative God.
Yeah.
And I do think that, I think that Clooney's right in what he says, in that I think the consciousness is an inevitable inevitable byproduct of matter and time left to run its course.
Yeah.
And I think it's all over the place. You know, when you look at those James Webb photos. Like, here's a photo with a billion dots, and each dot's a galaxy, and in each galaxy's a billion suns. And it's like, okay, well, we're not it. Like, I wonder, I do wonder that. Or maybe it's all just fucking matter just coalescing and nothing means anything. But, you know, if we are all a manifestation of the universe, which is a scientific fact.
Yeah.
Then, you know, it does make me wonder if we are just the universe contemplating itself.
Yeah. And that-
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I love that as an idea, and I love, and that's why I kind of love the idea of, okay, well, maybe the planet's trying to understand itself, because suddenly there's something there that's like, what is that?
Yeah.
And then by trying to understand that, taps in, and then this is the byproduct of it.
It's almost like it's sending emissaries out.
Yeah.
You know, like, you can't understand me, you can't understand the language of a planet.
Yeah.
So I will send an emissary that looks and speaks like you to try and communicate.
Yeah, but what none of them realized was it's, you know, and here's your dead wife.
Yeah.
Yeah, that you feel really guilty about.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
By the way, I do love a good poem in a sci-fi film. And Death Shall Have No Dominion is the Dylan Thomas poem that's in her hand, which he initially impresses her with. I'd completely forgotten that Viola Davis is in this film.
Same. That was a great moment where she pops out.
She's so good as Dr. Gordon, who tries to talk Kelvin out of wanting to take... he jettisons Raya out into space, and then he goes to sleep the next, like, he has an argument with all of them, and they're all like, well, don't go to sleep again. And then he goes to sleep again, and there's a new Raya there, and it's like, Jesus Christ. But then this time he wants to take this version back to Earth.
Yeah.
This Raya, because she's around longer, knows herself, knows that she lacks the emotional attachment that comes with her memories, and that they feel artificial. That's an interesting concept as well. And I wonder if that's going to be something that, you know, in the future, AI and the uploading of supposed consciousness is going to be, well, yeah, you have all these thoughts and these memories, but you won't have the experience of making them.
Yeah, I think that there will be profound ethical issues with creating artificial consciousness because of that.
You know?
And I mean, you know, I even feel a little bit of that with my human consciousness.
Right.
You know, I think you go through these massive periods of change throughout your life, and there is a conceptual continuity there.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's periods of my life I look back on and I have no, like, resonance with at all anymore.
Yeah.
To the point where it's like, I can't even, I understand where I was at when I was like that.
Right.
But I have no affinity for it anymore. And so I feel like certain periods of my life, certain memories from my life, it's kind of like, did that happen? Like, I know it happened to me, but did it happen to me? Like, in terms of who I am now. And you understand that it's all building towards what you are now.
Yeah.
But I do feel a sense of disconnect from it a little bit.
Yeah, well, I think I've got to be really careful with that as well, because I think that's one of the aspects of my personality that allows me to be able to move on from certain friendships, maybe a little bit too soon, I don't know. Maybe it's not necessarily a bad thing, but if I kind of feel like there's nothing new in the memories that are being created with the person now, then it's like, oh.
Do you sometimes feel there's an element of coldness in there?
Yeah, yeah. Same. Yeah. Yeah, I'm a bit of a cold fish. I'm definitely...
I feel that, right? And yeah. I don't know if that's... I'm like you. I don't know if that's good or bad. Like, a relationship will end.
Yeah.
And I'm not necessarily, like, distressed. It's like, yeah, that's... all, very few relationships last your whole life. Like,
yeah, yeah.
Things just come and go.
Yeah.
And it's not necessarily a, you know, it's not a tragedy that's kind of done now.
Yeah, I wonder if that's... like, do you get to that point because you had enough breakups when you were younger that you just don't want to go through that again? So there's always just a slight inability to be able to give fully of yourself to someone now. But, you know, I feel that way about certain, like, just mateships as well. Yeah, like, same. People that I really like, but I just have no urge to catch up with, and I'm also fine if they have no urge to catch up with me as well. It's like, yeah, that's cool.
You just have the time you have with people.
Yeah, and, you know, that time was great.
Yeah.
And this does not contradict that.
No, it's a question of growth and evolution. There's nothing sadder than people in their 50s or whatever age. But, like, that are very different from who they were 20, 30 years ago, still trying to maintain that persona.
Yeah.
When it's clearly like it's dead and gone.
Yeah. Yeah, there's it's definitely the friends that you suddenly realize that you're talking about all the things you used to do, and there's nothing new to that.
Mm-hmm.
There is a moment in the film which is completely confronting, which is the fact that the second version of Raya is, because she's so disconnected from these memories that she has and she knows that she hasn't built them, she commits suicide. And then she comes back to life.
Awful.
Did that scene remind you of any particular director that we may have covered really closely recently? I felt it was very David Lynch.
Right, of course.
The way she was all moving backwards, jerky, and it was all... It felt the really Lynchian. Stuff.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, and just also the existential horror of that. Like, could there be any fate worse than coming back to life after you've killed yourself?
Oh, my Lord. Like, it's terrifying. And they're all watching it as well. Yeah. And it's like, oh, God.
And they're all watching it with that kind of, like, passive science eye.
Yeah.
You're like, oh, I guess this is the thing that's happening now, rather than like just taking in the full horror of how it is.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's interesting. Viola Davis's character is scared that, you know, she doesn't want Rhea to go back because she's scared what happens if the world starts being populated
she's
by
correct.
Memories. Yeah.
She's 100%. She's, yeah. She's the most rational person in this entire film.
Yeah. Yeah, and Kelvin is driven mad by his grief and guilt over his real wife dying. And when Dr. Gordon tells him that she has created a machine that can destroy the manifestations, Kelvin is against it. So he tries to stay awake, taking stimulants so he won't abandon... So this time he won't abandon his wife to suicide. Mm. Eventually falls asleep and Rhea goes to Gordon to use the machine on her. And it's like, once again, I just keep thinking about this trailer and I'm like... No wonder people were turning up going, oh, this will be a nice frothy romantic comedy. I wonder if there'll be a scene where someone says, I'll have what she's having. Well, maybe not. It's fucking dark.
Yeah, it really is, right?
Like, there's so much.
Yeah.
But it's deep and it's, and I say that not in a condescending way, but there's a lot to sink your teeth into and discuss. But
well, you know, it's a movie about emotions and it's, yeah. It's you know, about being human and... again, like it really was kind of, I mean, obviously again, they're very different movies, but it was reminding me a lot of The Fountain.
Yeah.
In that it's, you know, it's about what it's about, but it's about so much more.
Yeah.
Like there's so much more going on about yeah. the human experience than just what the story is kind of flagging.
Yeah. Well, I think that's part of why I enjoyed it so much more this time around because it's, it feels like I'm trained more to appreciate all the different levels of what's going on in this film.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I definitely. Think Clooney's performance is magnificent as well.
He's great. He's great.
You know, it's... he looks so pained through so much of it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And again, just to, like drawing that kind of the Fountain comparison, I think it's a similar performance to what Hugh's doing in that movie in that... Yeah, he's racked with the guilt and the grief about his wife, but it's also him.
Yeah.
Like there's so much of, you know, his own existential fears and, you know, that's driving this.
Yeah.
You know, is it... there's that moment where it's clear that this is a terrible decision.
Yeah.
That this, whatever she is, entity...
Yeah.
...is... in living hell, doesn't want to exist.
Yeah.
And he refuses to allow her to terminate herself.
Yeah.
And it's not for her well-being.
Right. Yeah.
He's not doing it for anything other than his own selfish need to fix the mistakes of the past.
Yeah.
You know, so what is the motivation here? Is it love? I don't know.
It's like when they're talking about what are you going to do when you go back with her? Like, what are you going to sell everyone?
Hmm.
Oh, yeah. Here's my dead wife.
It's crazy.
There's another one floating around the planet in a space pod.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. I mean, that they bring that up with him at one point. You know, this other one's ditched out. And like, you know, there's not even a second thought to that. It's really nothing he's doing is for anyone's benefit but his own.
Yeah. Really goes mad, I think.
Yeah, he goes insane.
Yeah. You know. Like everyone else on that. Like, Viola Davis is angry.
Yeah.
So, you know, and... Well, it's probably a good time to get into the character of Snow, who I've kept until this point, and
little tweaked out fucker.
It's so I really like Jeremy Davies, and I can see where that performance is so mannered that people would hate it.
Yeah,
but I really like it.
No, I liked it.
I think it's pitch perfect.
Yeah.
And so, you know when you discover that he's a manifestation, is he a so he's a twin, right? And then he came to and the original Snow went, what? And attacked him and the manifestation killed him. And now he's just sitting in that room.
Yeah. He's trying to figure shit out.
Like, I love it.
Yeah. Well, you know, I wasn't put off by how mannered the performance was. But even if you are, I think once you find out what's actually going on.
Yeah.
And you realize that it's this, you know, however many days old manifestation that's kind of, you know, trying to figure out who and what it is.
Because, you know, like if Rhea was saying, I've got all these memories and I don't know how I've made them. Like, well, obviously this version of Snow has had the same thing and he's... just quietly going insane, trying to connect, and he's like I know he killed his brother, but he's kind of tragic.
Oh yeah, of course. Yeah. But I mean, that's part of the tragedy.
Yeah,
that, you know, within minutes of, you know, whatever, coming into existence, yeah, he's committed this horrific sin of killing his brother.
Yeah.
Like, he's got
the brother who manifested him.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's horrible. So, yeah, you know, he's dealing with all of that as well.
Yeah.
It's so how tweaked out and mattered the performance is in light of that, it completely makes sense.
Yeah. And the way he just kind of says, you know, that machine that you invented that destroyed the other manifestation has really used up a lot of the power, and Solaris has increased its mass and is drawing us in.
Yeah,
and he's just like, I'm just going to sit here.
If I were you, I'd just lock me in here and get out of here.
Yeah. It is so haunting. Ooh. And it's great. And so there's that part of my reasoning that Solaris is trying to know itself through them is why it increases its mass to draw them in.
Right.
To
you
know, connect even more so.
Sure.
So they have to escape. And they jump into a pod and they make their escape. Gordon and Kelvin make their escape back to Earth. And they leave poor Manifestation Snow to go down with the ship. Back home, Kelvin struggles to return to his normal life, haunted by the idea he remembered his dead wife incorrectly.
Mm.
Like, that's a...
Yeah.
Like, right at the end, that's a fascinating question as well. Yeah. Because as she keeps pointing out, this... I'm not even really her. This is how you remember me, and you remember me with the floor of suicide.
Yeah, yeah, that's something I've struggled with a bit. You know, when people go, "Oh, they'll never die as long as they live on in our memory," and it's like, they're dead. Like, the memory is not who they were. Like, well, I can't even remember the voice of my fucking grandparents anymore.
Right.
I can't remember what they. You know, occasionally I'll get it's like a faint smell on the air kind of thing, you know, like you get a kind of a wisp of it, but I can't, you know, they're gone.
Well, and it's funny, it's because, you know, now that we know that memory isn't photographic, it is a recreation every time, and that's every time you recreate it just fades more and more. And that's why, so what's the specificity that you remember of your grandparents? Because I'm the same as you. I can't remember my grandfather's voice, but I can remember his yellow fingers from smoking.
Yeah, right. Yeah, no, there is specificity. The texture of my grandma's hands.
Yeah.
You know, like, I remember their essence. I remember, you know, like, the memories are all beautiful memories.
Yeah.
And they definitely have profound influence. And I cherish them, but I'm also very aware that these are just creations of my brain.
Yeah.
And, you know, how much of what I'm remembering is actually the way it was versus how I would like it to be.
Yeah.
Or the best bits.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of kind of cutting and pasting that goes on. That's just what memory is.
Yeah.
Yeah, so all of that is to say that I was particularly haunted or emotional with that notion.
Yeah.
Of, you know, the manifestation saying, you know, I'm not even real. I'm your memory of and the memory is a flawed memory.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, it's not so disturbing when I talk about someone. People like my grandparents, because, you know, that was all good.
Right.
But, you know, you got to wonder what happens when someone who you have maybe a fractured relationship with passes.
Yeah.
You know, and then you're remembering them a decade later. Like, you know, like, are you accentuating the bad bits or...
Yeah.
And forgetting the good.
Yeah.
You know, what's left of that person?
Well, you know, one of the things that I had to really get my head around, it took me a long time, was a dear friend of mine died a long time ago now, and because it was such a shock, and she was only 31, you know, it was one of the things that I had to make a choice on was I always used to post something on the anniversary, on her birthday, I think. Was it her birthday or anniversary of her death? Something like that. And I used to post something all the time, and then I realized that after a while, even though the intention was good, it was reinforcing the tragedy of her, and I needed to remember her in the full way, which was, you know, heaps of fun, you know, really in-depth conversations, you know, as a good friend, you know. So I had to remember that. So I had to stop doing that.
Because
I was reinforcing the wrong parts.
It's the reason I can't go to, you know, my mum goes to my grandparents' grave quite a lot. It's right. Like, I don't, like, why?
Yeah.
Like, maybe that's some kind of coldness coming through, but it's just like, it was nearly 20 years ago. I just, like, dying was one thing they did.
Yeah.
It was just one thing they did.
Yeah.
They did heaps of shit.
Yeah.
And I understand the probably not just human need, but, you know, higher mammalian need to return to the remains of a loved one and pay tribute, and, you know, elephants do it.
Yeah.
So I'm not denying that there's some kind of primal need there, but I don't feel anything when I go there.
Yeah.
It's just, that's just, like, it's just a stone and...
Yeah.
You know, like when people say, oh, they're down there. No, they're not.
No.
Their bones are down there.
Yeah.
But like, if all they were their bones, that's pretty fucking depressing, man. Like, yeah. They, you know.
Yeah.
Whatever they were left the day they died.
Right.
What they really were.
Yeah.
What you cherish. What means something.
Yeah.
Like, it's like a cicada shell down there. Like, what is it even fucking, what is it?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think remembering people in your own way is probably the more profound thing. You know? And celebrating their lives in your own memory, in your own, there's a profundity to it that's maybe, I don't know, less kind of performative or staid or something, you know, prescriptive.
Yeah. And it's important to engage with that memory, like I said, and make sure that it doesn't just end on the awful part.
And that's something that I've said to people a lot. That's something I said to my mum a lot, you know, where, you know, it's like, don't just focus on the death.
Yeah.
You know, it's not to say that it's not sad and tragic and upsetting and all the rest, but if that's all you remember,
yeah,
my God, like that's like what a tragedy to their memory.
Yeah, yeah, no, I totally agree with that, and that's kind of what this movie, part of what it's sort of saying as well.
Yeah.
Back on Earth, we see Kelvin cutting food again. He cuts his finger, and his finger immediately heals, and we realize that he never returned to Earth. He stayed on the ship, and as it plummeted towards Solaris, Jabarian's son appears and offers his hand in assistance. He looks like Michelangelo's The Creation of Adam. And you know, the once again, getting back to my theory on what Solaris is doing, because that's a manifestation. I think the boy is reaching out to Kelvin, is Solaris reaching out.
Yeah.
And in the end, I think Kelvin dies, but now Solaris dreams of the life of Kelvin and Rhea, and through that, this peaceful place finds a new understanding of itself. That's where I landed.
Beautiful, because I didn't see it that way, and I much prefer the way you see it.
Yeah, how did you see it?
Well, I saw it as like kind of like quite a sad, depressing ending where it's like he's just surrendering to living in a false memory for the sake of that he can't face his grief and emotions.
Right.
And instead of, you know, kind of, you know, powering through and becoming a more evolved person.
Yeah.
Which I guess, you know, if he stays, that kind of is still true. He stays on the ship.
Yeah, he stays on the ship. Yeah.
So there is that there. But no, I much prefer that ending. That's beautiful.
Yeah. Well, I think both are true.
Yeah.
I think he gives in.
Yeah.
And then Solaris, you know, because as the... this manifestation of Rhea, like how many manifestations have there been by this stage, is saying, you know, we're beyond the concepts of life and death.
That's right. And you don't have to worry about that anymore, she says. Yeah. Yes, yes, that's right. Yeah, because I was thinking about the original Solaris, and there's a real... it doesn't end as beautifully. It's almost like he's trapped on an island in the middle of the, you know... it's like... and I don't know that he's dead. I think he seems trapped.
Yes, yes.
But I think you're right. I think he's dead.
Yeah, yeah. I think he's dead, and that's the memories and the thoughts and the kind of working through itself. It all gets back to me. The reason I got to that point was that debate about God and the statistical possibility that it would happen and blah, blah, blah. So that's beautiful. That's where I came to. That's what I mean. I didn't feel that way when I first saw it.
Yeah. That's beautiful.
But through all these movies that we've watched and discussed, you suddenly start seeing extra levels.
Yeah.
Fuck, I wish we were friends with Steven Soderbergh and George Clooney and they were here with us and we could say, these are our thoughts. Who are the top directors that we've discussed, or not even the top directors, but which directors are you would you love to discuss and say, hey, these are our thoughts on your movie?
I tell you, it's the movie we haven't talked about yet. I really would love to talk about The Fountain.
Oh yeah.
I would love to talk about it, and because I think there is so much, and I think similar to Solaris, I think everything that we've watched, I think would really add a new dimension to that movie.
Yeah, and let's do it before the end of the year.
I would love to, man. Yeah. I think that's a movie that I would love to convince other people to watch a lot.
Yes,
and I think it's, I know I've talked about it a lot in terms of its thematic resonance to this. And probably people don't know what I'm talking about because it's one of those great unseen gems. But I think
we're like one of the three people that saw it.
It's a beautiful, beautiful movie.
Yeah.
But that's a movie I have a lot of thoughts on.
Yeah.
And I would love to, if I ever saw Hugh Jackman or Aronofsky on the street, I would, I wouldn't even say anything. I'd just go, thank you. Thanks for The Fountain.
Yep. That's so funny. What's that Scorsese film, Melandra, is it? Or you know that really obscure Scorsese film? And it's one of the great scenes in...
What's it about?
Hang on, let me find it because it's such a funny light. So in the... The Sopranos, there is, they're all mafioso guys all fucking love...
Goodfellas.
They all love Scorsese and the young guy, Christopher, sees Scorsese and he yells out, I really love Condon.
Like, Condon,
yeah.
The Dalai Lama. That's great.
Yeah, so that would be, you know, that's our equivalent. Hey, Soderbergh, Solaris is a fucking masterpiece, mate.
He'd probably love it.
Yeah, he might be.
He would, because he'd get all these dudes kind of going, Ocean's 11, man. Yeah. I'm not shitting on that, but, you know, I think when a movie's this kind of personal, like, I can't imagine that he hasn't poured a lot of his own perspective into this. Of course it is.
Yeah.
And so, you know, to have something resonate that's so personal with an audience would be profound for an artist.
Yeah.
I mean, Hugh Jackman still to this day says that The Fountain's the best film he ever did.
Oh yeah, it's fascinating.
He knows it. He knows it.
I read an interview with Brad Pitt who talked about the best, like when people talk about the best films he's made. It's for him, it's the assassination of Jesse James, which
great movie,
which was once again seen by five people and great bombed. Movie. But he's right.
He's right.
Yeah.
No, it gives you a brief insight into how deep these people actually are. You know, I think everyone loves someone like Hugh Jackman, obviously.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's easy to just go, yeah, Wolverine.
Yeah. Okay, segment who and how. Which character do you think you would be and how would you react in their place?
Viola Davis.
Oh, you'd be Viola Davis, be furious. I reckon I'd be the Dead Snow. And I would just... keep bleeding up in the rafters. I'd be exactly like him. Segment zero charisma.
Oh. I actually think zero charisma for me is the doctor that summons them to the
Shabarian.
Like there was something in he was almost like cut Price Stellan Skarsgård.
That's so funny. Yeah, I was just telling you beforehand that I just watched Melancholia and loved it. Yeah. And Stellan Skarsgård was so good.
He's so good. Yeah, that's what it reminded me of. It reminded me of like, we can't get Stellan, we'll get this dude.
That's funny.
And there was like, I enjoyed some of the ideas that were coming across in that God versus no God debate, but it also kind of reeked a bit of the acting, reeked a bit of like Philosophy 101 kind of like, you know, like, whoa, these are my thoughts on the creator.
Right. I was going to say the little boy. I thought that little boy could have fucking done something interesting rather than just run around. Just say something. Just ask for a sandwich, you piece of shit. So, segment better or worse? Mm. So, I really love this film, right? And we'll talk more about the failure of the film at the box office in the squid bits. But I don't think you should do this. But could you possibly make this film a slightly bigger hit if you add a little bit of Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind / Inception, like, you know, just with the dreamscapes, try to give the film a little bit of action? I personally wouldn't, but I kind of thought you, Solaris probing the mind and Kelvin trying to hide his thoughts or find his deeper thoughts for his wife, you know.
I think I like it as an idea. I think it would make it a fundamentally very different movie.
I think so too. This was more of a writing exercise. I also thought you could maybe make it darker. He just keeps jettisoning her out into space until he can remember her, right?
That's great.
It's like, fucking hell, let's double down. There's like, at the end of the film, the way the film ends is you see 237 probes just floating around Solaris and they're all just looking at each other, bumping into each other. If I wanted to ruin the movie, I'd add a lovable robot who makes jokes all the way through the film and then in the end says, if only I could dream, then someone would come for me. little Sparky.
Yeah.
He's got some shit name.
Oh,
like
Short
that.
Circuit.
Segment, where are we now? So how this is your segment that you inspired. How close are we to the technology in the film? So this was a tricky one, but in the movie, they have Gordon talk about a device that emits Higgs bosons. This is an elementary subatomic particle whose existence was predicted in 1964 by Peter Higgs and five other physicists. The particle wasn't actually observed until 2012, and in 2013, Mr. Higgs and one of his colleagues were awarded the Nobel Prize for their theoretical work. The Higgs boson, or the God particle as it was nicknamed, was detected at the Large Hadron Collider, which is the most powerful particle accelerator on the planet.
Yep.
If computers once filled rooms and can now fit in our pocket, then who is to say that the apparatus that's on that ship wouldn't be able to fit in a spaceship? I think this might be the first time where are we now? We're actually ahead of it.
Yeah, absolutely. That the Higgs boson, the Large Hadron Collider in CERN, that's the source of a lot of conspiracy theories these days.
Yes.
A lot of the anti-vax people are convinced that there's some nefarious shit going on there.
Oh, right. Well, there was, you know, so do you remember, like, back when conspiracy theories were fun and cool, until fucking anti-vaxxers ruined everything, you pieces of shit. If you want to bring back polio, fucking fine, but don't ruin my ability to enjoy an old episode of The X-Files. You know,
I don't even know if it's the anti-vaxxers. I think it's more QAnon than the anti-vaxxers.
The Venn diagram.
It is a Venn diagram, but yeah, QAnon took it to a whole new level.
Yeah. So my favorite theory on that was, remember there were things that just kept going wrong when they were setting it up
at CERN.
Yeah. And it was, you know, and there was like random things. I can't quite remember this because it was a while ago, but it was just like a bird got in there threw it out. And it's like, you know, the idea of it's such a bad idea that time keeps correcting itself and you know, it just keeps going clonk. Like, you know, you couldn't go back and kill your the gun would jam. You can't kill your grandfather.
Yeah,
Or it's people from the future coming in going, fuck, just drop a spanner in there. Like,
turn it off. Don't turn that on.
Yeah.
For a while, they were convinced, some people were convinced that it could tear open a black hole.
Black hole. Yeah.
Scary shit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But
it was fine. They just discovered a new subatomic particle.
Yeah. It was never going to do that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Segment, sum it up. What does this movie mean to you?
I think it's a beautiful meditation on grief and regret and the dangers of not squaring yourself with the past.
Yeah, I feel the same way. That's a really good summation. I've also added it's a smart, cerebral movie full of integrity, and it is because of this that I understand why it wasn't a hit.
Yeah, of course.
It's a bit lost to time as well. Like, it's not splashy. It tells its story in a really compact way.
Yeah.
Like, so much happens in a very short amount of time without ever losing that beautiful pace.
Mm-hmm.
And I reckon this is one of those movies where it's like, oh, this is like this is vaulted right up into the upper echelon.
Yeah, and definitely.
I've been on a bit of a Clooney roll recently. I rewatched Michael Clayton for
never seen
first time. It is.
I know. I've heard great.
Really
things.
Good. There's some great Clooney
good
films.
Good night, good luck. You should watch that. Good night and good luck.
So I saw that film. Mm. I saw a preview of it at Nova Cinema with Adam Richard, actually. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you get to the end of the film and David Strathairn was there. He was coming out to do chat afterwards. Yeah, right. And then who knows why this happened? Like, you know, you paid good money for it. You know, the big speech at the end.
One of the great speeches of old. I transcribed that speech the first time I saw it.
Well, this is going to blow
your
mind.
Amazing speech.
On this night, the sound drops out.
Oh, God.
And to be honest, you're sitting there going, oh, right, this speech is, it's so big, we're not going to hear it. You know what I mean? Like, that's what you're sitting there thinking. Oh, this is a bold choice. You've been working towards this speech.
Yeah.
And it's so big that words, like, hearing it is going to do it a disservice. Yeah, so they've decided you're just going to see him give it. And then you're like, but surely there would be something on the soundtrack. This doesn't seem just right. Like, there would be And then right at the end of the film, it was almost like it wasn't this, but it was a little bit like silence. And then it was like, and that's why I called the speech good night and good luck. The end. And it was like, everyone was just like, what the fuck happened? So then Strathairn comes in with the host and that, and they have this beautiful chat, and he's so charming and he's so charismatic. And then they say, any questions? And someone in the audience says, what did you say at the end? And everyone laughs really hard, like, because it's a collective laugh. And Strathairn and that are like going, what just happened? And someone explains to them what happens.
He did the speech. Holy fuck, that's so cool.
He did the speech in the cinema. Wow. And it is, if something is going to fuck up, like, you've now given me a moment.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
Yeah.
I love that speech.
Yeah. And the fact that he remembered it. And that, just did it.
It's one
like
of
he didn't even warm up and did not miss a beat.
Mm. It's one of the most prophetic things that I've ever heard. I mean, God, when did that movie come out? 2006, 2007?
Yeah, 2007.
I remember watching it at the time going, holy fuck, they knew everything back, you know, when this thing first was invented.
Yeah.
And my God, it must be 1,000 times more applicable now.
Yeah. Some squid bits for you. Not a lot on this film, but James Cameron spent close to 5 years trying to secure the rights for Solaris from author Stanislaw Lem and Russian film studio Mosfilm.
Mm-hmm.
So they collectively own the rights to Andrei Tarkovsky's 1972 film. But due to all his 90s commitments, he couldn't direct it. Cameron said, what I would have done would have been more like The Abyss, where visual set pieces might have gotten in the way of what is a clean line as a relationship film. Soderbergh's not interested in the hardware of the visual effects very much, which is good.
Oh, good on you, Cameron.
Yeah. Originally, Daniel Day-Lewis was intended to play the lead, but was busy making Martin Scorsese's Gangs of New York. I can see Daniel Day-Lewis.
Yeah, he should have done it. Oh, well. I'm glad Clooney's in it, but Gangs of New York.
You know, that is...
His performance is outstanding, but that movie ain't good.
I have to be honest. I got 10 minutes into that film and I was like, I'm not in the mood for this.
It's not a good movie.
And I haven't gone back to it.
No.
You've
never seen it?
No. Well, no.
Okay.
I don't know what it is. It just never quite appealed.
It has aged real bad. There's some camera techniques in it that have really aged terribly. Right. I mean, again, he's incredible.
Yeah.
He's always incredible.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's not a great movie.
Yeah. Clooney and Soderbergh had their company Section 8 Productions, and when Clooney read the script, he sent Soderbergh a letter saying he was ready to step into the role. He's a prolific letter writer.
Oh, really?
That's always been something that I'm like, I like the idea of being a letter writer and just posting a letter to a friend and, you know, you having taken the time to write by hand. It feels like a nice thing to do.
It really is. I remember hearing about Groucho Marx being a prolific letter
writer.
Have
you ever read the Groucho letters?
I've read some of them. Yeah,
man.
They're
magnificent.
Great.
The letters to Jerry Lewis about breaking up with Dean Martin is, like, they're beautiful.
Okay.
Right? And, you know, the back and forth of him trying to talk them out of it. But then also, have you read the letter to Warner Brothers, who were trying to sue them for being, not let them use the they were going to do one night in Casablanca, and they didn't want them to use Casablanca because they had their film, and he sends this fucking withering letter about, I'm not even sure that you're the original brothers. There were the, we were brothers before you. There were the brothers Karamazov, you know, and it's just this literal, beautiful, like one of the best comedy pieces you'll ever read.
Yeah.
So the sex scenes in this film were done on a closed set with only Clooney, McElhone and Soderbergh. Literally, only Soderbergh. He filmed all those scenes with a handheld camera.
Yeah.
And he was also the film's cinematographer and editor, both credited under pseudonyms.
Right.
Now, do you know why that is? Like, why would he do that under a pseudonym? Why wouldn't he just... Is that something to do with the unions or...
I don't know.
Why
maybe, is that? Maybe it's him just kind of not wanting to suck up all the oxygen and have people be distracted by like... Ooh.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. Yeah, maybe that's... I meant to look that up before, but I've always been a bit confused by that. So the movie had poor box office receipts, making roughly $30 million against a $47 million budget. Soderbergh said the marketing campaign was a challenge, and Clooney stated that the film's trailers and commercials had nothing to do with the film, depicting more of a science fiction love story or thriller. And looking at the trailer, they are correct. Mm. The author of the book, Stanislaw Lem, never saw the film, but criticised where he heard they took the story. He didn't like the film focusing on the relationship between the two main characters and reducing the vast and alien ocean to a mere mirror of humanity. Mm. He also said... To my best knowledge, the book was not dedicated to erotic problems of people in outer space. As Solaris author, I shall allow myself to repeat that I only wanted to create a vision of a human encounter with something that certainly exists in a mighty manner, in a manner perhaps, but cannot be reduced to concepts, ideas, or images. This is why the book was entitled Solaris and not Love in Outer Space. Good Burns. Good burn, Stanislaw.
He's great.
The movie was originally given an R rating because of Clooney's bare bum.
Oh, for fuck. Americans are so stupid.
They're so stupid. And Soderbergh appealed the decision and it was granted a PG-13 rating.
Shooting someone in the head, fine. Bum, bum, bad.
Okay. Yeah. Ulrich Tucker, the person that you decided had zero charisma, his audition tape for Jabarian had his dog listening intently to him as he spoke his lines.
He's gone up in my estimation.
Yeah, I thought that might help win you over. Jabarian's line, "There are no answers, only choices," echoes Nietzsche's quote, "There are no facts, only interpretations." Nietzsche, of course, also believed that we are predetermined to repeat the past, so that makes sense. This version of the film is an hour shorter than the 1972 Russian film.
Yes, it is.
And finally, it received an F cinema score from audiences in 2002.
Well,
what do you reckon it would get now? Like, it might not be.
I reckon it would, if this was released now, as like, yeah, say, whatever, like as an A24 movie.
Yes.
I think it would get glowing reviews.
Yeah. Yeah.
If it was just released as one of those, you know, mid budget, you know, indie films.
Yeah.
I think people would love it.
Yeah.
I think the audiences have opened themselves up to this. It, you know, it would never be a blockbuster.
No, no.
But it would have a small following of people that love it.
Yeah. I don't like to read reviews out, especially of Roger Ebert, because there is a high-profile movie podcast that does that. But when I was just... Because I was curious to see how it was accepted. And Ebert said, "At a time when many American movies pump up every fugitive emotion into a clanging assault on the audience, Soderbergh's Solaris is quiet and introspective. There are some shocks and surprises, but this is not Alien. It is a workshop for a discussion of human identity. It considers not only how we relate to others, but how we relate to our idea of others, so that a completely phony, non-human replica of a dead wife can inspire the same feelings that the wife herself once did. That is a peculiarity of humans. We feel the same emotions for our ideas as we do for the real world, which is why we can cry while reading a book or fall in love with movie stars. Our idea of humanity bewitches us, while humanity itself stays safely sealed away into its billions of separate containers or people. when I saw Tarkovsky's original film, I felt absorbed in it as if it were a sponge. It was slow, mysterious, confusing, and I have never forgotten it. Soderbergh's version is more clean and spare, more easily readable, but it pays full attention to the ideas and it doesn't compromise. Tarkovsky was a genius, but one who demanded great patience from his audience as he ponderously marched towards his goals. The Soderbergh version is like the same story, free from the weight of Tarkovsky's solemnity, and it evokes one of the rarest of movie emotions, ironic regret.
And I thought, good job, Roger.
Yeah. So
that's great.
As I said, I don't like to step on other people's places, but I read that and I was like,
no, that's outstanding. I'm not always a fan of Roger, but when he gets it right, he fucking gets it right.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that was a good one, right?
Good one. Good suggestion. One. I wouldn't have rewatched that had you not suggested it.
Oh, good. Yeah.
It was one of those ones that was like, oh, yeah, I've ticked that off the list.
Yeah.
No need to revisit.
No, it was good, and you know, good to see George just be fucking so great. I love him so much. Thank you to Ben for his insights into this movie, and a big thank you to Salicia for being our Patreon supporter for the episode. I hope you enjoyed this podcast and possibly enjoy the film as well. Remember, if you'd like to join the Big Squid community, head to patreon.com/JustinHamilton_BigSquid and you will find a tier that suits you. That is patreon.com/JustinHamilton_BigSquid. Also, my solo show Little Victories will be appearing in Sydney on the 28th of October and Comedy Republic on the 26th of November. Remember to use the Big Squid promo podcast to get a cheaper ticket. I'd love you to come along if you're in either city. And once again, you can find details at bigsquidpod.com, along with blogs, short stories, and all manner of extra entertainment. If you haven't had time yet, please check out my dear friend Anna Lidner's show, A Beginner's Guide to Grief, on the SBS platform before it ends this week. It really is wonderful, and all six eps go barely longer than an hour. I think you'll love it. And I'm just so impressed with what she's done. So if you can check it out, please do so. I will be back next week with more Chitter Chatter and podcasts. But as you know, we normally finish with a quote from someone. But today I thought we'd do something a little different and appropriate considering the movie we just watched. Today we're going to finish with Dylan Thomas' poem, "And Death Shall Have No Dominion." And death shall have no dominion. Dead men naked, they shall be one with the man and the wind and the west moon. When their bones are picked clean and the clean bones gone, they shall have stars at elbow and foot. Though they go mad, they shall be sane. Though they sink through the sea, they shall rise again. Though lovers be lost, love shall not, and death shall have no dominion. And death shall have no dominion. Under the windings of the sea, their lying long shall not die windily. Twisting on racks when sinews give way, strapped to a wheel, yet they shall not break. Faith in their hands shall snap in two, and the unicorn evils run them through. Split all ends up, they shan't crack, and death shall have no dominion. And death shall have no dominion. No more gulls cry at their ears, or waves break loud on the seashores. Where blew a flower, may a flower no more lift its head to the blows of the rain. Though they be mad and dead as nails, heads of the characters hammer through daisies, break in the sun till the sun breaks down, and death shall have no dominion. Until then.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
A change of seasons means adventures in rain, shine, mist, or snow. Or all of the above on the same day. This season, prepare for every season with the Allbirds Mizzle Collection. With all-condition traction and materials and features to keep you comfy and dry no matter what, you'll be ready for anything. Go to allbirds.com and use code FRESHSOCKS for a free pair of socks with your purchase. Allbirds.com, code FRESHSOCKS.